We could start with some questions, if any one of you have some questions or thoughts from last week or the last 2 weeks, or comments or thoughts about virtue or generosity. One of the things you should know about the Buddha's teaching on karma is that it said that you create very good karma of for yourself if you ask questions. Of course.
And I really, just thinking about being generous about it and letting go, I guess, of my need to have it be a certain way, and start listening to them. It wasn't easy to do, but you know, I really noticed how. Just thinking about being generous, how much I wasn't, and how much I was attached to.
So you saw yourself much better.
Yeah.
And you saw how difficult it is to work with yourself, and you saw the situation worked out better if you were paused a little bit and were a little bit more generous, or also. So I think that's very instructive that what you said, that it was difficult, how difficult it is. Practicing generosity and practicing virtue sometimes can be quite difficult, but the place where our practice occurs, the place where we get to learn about ourselves and work with ourselves, is kind of can be really obvious. And sometimes when you sit in meditation and close your eyes, it's not so obvious where the edge of practice is. So it's really wonderful to think of Buddhist practice as including generosity. It highlights things, it shows things, it shows where practice should be really, really well. I'll say more about that, but yes.
Can you say something about how you can be generous to yourself? Because sometimes that's hard, because generosity is always
giving out. Well, I think being generous to yourself is as important as being generous to anyone else. The interesting thing about Buddhist spirituality is that there is there's no basis upon which to treat someone else as being more worthy than yourself. That each person is inherently precious and important, and you would treat yourself as you would treat anybody else. To denigrate yourself or put yourself last is considered to be kind of unhealthy. To put yourself first maybe is a little bit unhealthy too, but to treat yourself as kind of equal to everyone, and you would be just as generous to yourself as you would to someone else. So if you're stressed out, then you need to give yourself time to relax. If you have a certain kind of need, you're as worthy of that need as anybody else. And if you don't take care of yourself properly, take care of your body properly, your mind, your heart properly, then you're not really going to be very good for helping others and being generous to others. When we're deeply settled on ourselves, it's a lot easier to be generous. Yes?
So it goes to a radical thing that the homeless person giving them $1 or $2, whatever, is not really going to do much for them. There's so much more they need that at least when I do that, I feel a little better about who I am as opposed to just walking by and ignoring. But we're, you know, to find a balance of what to do and where, you know, how much we can do.
Yeah, it's a lot of reflection, a lot of thought goes into that, those kinds of concerns, and I think it's very valuable. And, our relationship to society at large is a very important question, and there's no clear answers, I think, but to be up against the edge of these questions of what is appropriate and how far can we go, and is something I think a healthy person is always considering and wondering where the balance is. So we're not looking for a spirituality that kind of gives us final answers. We're giving spirituality, which is puts us at the edge, so that we kind of are exploring a realistic relationship with the world around us. So that's one of them. The other thing about giving a dollar to someone who's homeless is that you might reframe what you're doing. And not think about it so much about it's the money. If the money's not going to make much difference. But think about it that you're offering your kindness. And it just happens to be it's through the vehicle of a dollar. And some people need more the human connection than they need the money. And if you go down the street and you just kind of like look the other way when you're giving the dollar, that has a much that's very different than actually stopping and saying, you know, hello, here, I'd like to give you this. And actually say, I'd like to give you this. So they sense a human connection. And so the generosity is very different in those two circumstances. Yes?
Can you comment for a moment on the relationship between virtues, especially outline and humor? To find myself confident, sometimes it's easy to exaggerate in a sense of humor or irony or something. Just try to make your friends and realize that you're really kind of leaving a non truth.
The question is, what about not lying and using humor that might be exaggeration or bantering? It might not be really honest to what you're saying, but it's in the bantering and playfulness of being with friends. Is that breaking that precept? And that's really for you to reflect on. I think the intention behind what you're doing is important. If you're intending to deceive someone, that's really much more the issue. If you if no one's being deceived by your jokes, I don't think it's really lying. Then it's transparent what you're doing, perhaps. There's a lot of times in society it's kind of like pretty accepted that there's a kind of a white lie that most people say. Some people say it many times a day, and that is, how are you? And the expected answer is fine, or okay. And then they want to talk about something else. It's like a little formality, to kind of like a ritual, to kind of get people kind of lined up. And if you say, "Oh, thanks for asking," sit down, let me tell you. That's not what they want. So it's kind of like so we have this ritual, that involves, in a sense, maybe even not saying the truth. Now it's possible to kind of turn it around and say something more honest and say, "Well, I'm getting by." Or okay, I guess is okay, because okay is what does that mean? But I think if people understand what you're doing, then I don't think it's a lie, if you're a joke. But now some humor belongs to the category of malicious speech. So it's not it might not be exactly lying, but it's at the expense of someone else's dignity or someone else's happiness, and so part of a right speech in Buddhism is not just refraining from lying, but also avoiding harsh speech, malicious speech, and gossip. So, Buddhism, the Buddha offered a path, and it called in Sanskrit it's called marga, in Pali, which is the language we use, kind of a derivative of Sanskrit, it's magga. It calls it a path. And different traditions of spirituality in India each offered their own marga, their own path. And so it wasn't so much an ism that Buddhism is. The word Buddhism is a Western invention. Do you know that? There is no such word in... And the word religion is a Western invention. And when English or Western languages came to like places like Sri Lanka and Japan and different places in Asia, they scratched their head for a while. What in the world is this? How are we going to translate this word into our language? We don't have any word, religion. Can you imagine a whole culture that doesn't have a word for religion? But marga was one, a path. We offer a path. And what's obvious with using the word path is that it's something you do. It's something you walk. You have to walk your talk or whatever. And whereas an ism, for many people's mind, implies a belief. I believe something. And there's a huge difference between believing something and walking it. And some scholars make a distinction between religions which focus on orthodoxy versus orthopraxy. You know those words? Orthodoxy, doxy means teaching. Ortho means right. So some religions focus on right teaching, and other religions focus on right practice. Like Judaism, some people consider is more orthopraxy than orthodoxy. It's more about how, you know, the things you do. And Buddhism also is more of an orthopraxic religion than orthodoxic religion. It's more interested in what we do than what we believe. And in fact, it's been said that it doesn't really matter so much what you believe, as long as what you believe helps you get to liberation or doesn't stand in the way of it. So when many of us went to Asia to practice, they never asked us what we believed in. And they never tried to tell us what to believe. They said, try this practice out. And then they gave us all kinds of opportunities to practice. And they didn't care if we remained Christian or Jews or Muslim or whatever. That was kind of besides the point for them. I had one, I was a TA at Stanford in a Buddhist studies class. And there was this freshman from Kentucky. And she came just, I don't know, she probably just came out of rural Kentucky and never seen the world before, maybe. That was the impression I had. And she took this freshman class, you know, Introduction to Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And I said to her that Buddhism doesn't see religion as an issue of exclusivity. That it's, you know, you have to choose Buddhism over something else. You know, it's either you're Buddhist or you're Christian, but you can't be both. Either you're a Presbyterian or a Unitarian, but you can't be both. You know, I don't know if that works, but, you know. Western religion has this thing about, you know, this is who you are, your identity, and you can't be more than one at a time. And that's like a foreign idea to Buddhist culture. If you do it, when they do a censuses of Japan, there's about 100 million Japanese. And they'll do a census to see what religious affiliation Japanese have. And it's something like 70 million are Buddhist. Something like 60 million are Shinto. And something like 30 million are Christian. And, you know, it adds up to a lot more than 100 million. Because they have, they're very comfortable with the idea that, you know, that religions aren't something you divide people. Just you would go, and for different reasons, you'd have different religious affiliations. So Buddhism offers a practice, a path and practice that anybody can follow. And so this idea of a pyramid that I've been emphasizing is in walking that path, you want to have really good foundation for walking that path. And so you want to create the strong foundation at the bottom. And then it becomes a lot safer to go into some of the depths of the wilderness at the heights of the path will take you. And another analogy about the kind of the path and how it develops. I don't know if I use this. Did I talk about sandpaper to you? I said sandpaper. Some of you heard this before, but maybe not in this class, so I can do it again. You know, if you take a piece of wood, it's coarse and rough. You start with rough sandpaper, and then you kind of do as much work as the rough sandpaper can do. And then you take a finer sandpaper, and you do what that can do. And then you take a finer sandpaper and do what that can do. And finally, you get just down to a piece of cloth, you know, just kind of, you know, doing the last little polish. And so the same thing is true with spiritual growth. It works better if you start with coarse sandpaper. Don't use the analogy too much, but don't imagine it too much. But you kind of want to work with what's most obvious and easiest work, which stands out, you know, most dramatically. And you don't want to get into the work and the fine details of the practice before you're kind of taking care of that, what's more considered easiest to take care of. And so in the tradition, it's considered a lot easier to take care of your behavior than it is to take care of your speech. And it's a lot easier to take care of your speech than it is to take care of what your mind does. So you start with your behavior. So things like ethics has a lot to do with behavior. You're not going to punch your neighbor out. That's behavior, right? Or you're not going to steal. You're not going to lie. You're not going to do these kinds of things that are behavioral. And what happens as we try to negotiate that kind of coarse behavior, it's kind of obvious for the most part if we're punching someone out or not. And so you can see what you're doing. You see that impulse of what you're going to do, and you get feedback right away. Even if you don't do it, you can feel the impulse, you feel what's going on. And you can work at this relatively coarse level and try to refine that coarse level, smooth it out, so that your virtue is settled. Generosity belongs to that same level. It's something you do. You give. You offer something. And so we're taking care of kind of a coarser level first. And the suggestion I have to you is that it's a lot easier to engage in personal development and spiritual development if you develop it in areas first that are kind of in the obvious realm. And my suggestion is that ethics and generosity are much more the obvious realm than the subtlety of a very concentrated mind. You know, when you get really, really concentrated, at what point do you let go of the initial application of attention? What point do you let go of the sustained application of attention? At what point do you let go of your equanimity? Can you see the difference between equanimity and can you see the subtle differences between joy and happiness? I mean, that's what a very concentrated mind can do. But in meditation, but you shouldn't get ahead of yourself. So the idea is work on this larger level first, the coarser level or the more obvious level first of your life. Take care of that. And when that's taken care of, then you can go to a finer piece of sandpaper and work on something that's more refined. In this case, start doing meditation practice. What I want to talk about today is the next layer of the pyramid, or the next finer sandpaper that you can use, and that is the Buddha's teachings on love. And love and kindness are very, very important aspects of Buddhist spirituality. Many of you know the Dalai Lama has said that his religion is kindness. He doesn't say his religion is Buddhism. He says his religion is kindness. And that inspires a lot of people. That he would put that at the forefront of his religion. There is about 10 years ago or so, there was a meeting of Western Buddhist teachers, a gathering of Buddhist teachers from different Buddhist traditions, Zen tradition, Tibetan tradition, Vipassana, Theravada tradition. And they met to talk about the issues they had in common. And they spent a week together. And at the end of that week, they wrote an open letter that they all signed. So kind of like a platform, maybe, or a view or understanding they all shared that they felt was important to get out to the world. And this is one part of this letter. Our first responsibility as Buddhists is to work towards creating a better world for all forms of life. The promotion of Buddhism as a religion is a secondary concern. Kindness and compassion, the furthering of peace and harmony, as well as tolerance and respect for other religions, should be the three guiding principles of our actions. Kindness, as teachers, kindness and compassion, that's the first. Furthering of peace and harmony is the second. And tolerance for other religions is the third. Those are the guiding principles that these teachers felt, all felt they could share. And I think it's pretty marvelous that these different Buddhist traditions can come together and make a statement like this. And rather than thinking that they're making a statement which is the common denominator, the kind of the light stuff they could all agree on, I take this to be something very profound and very significant. So the idea of kindness and compassion, the idea that we live our life in relationship to other people, that it's not just a self-serving approach of spirituality, but that we live our life as if other people matter and as if our relationship to other people matter. That's a very important part of this path, about this another layer of this foundation. It's a relatively coarser thing than the more subtle work of deep meditation. But it's very important to take care of that. And in fact, I think that these people, and I would say, if you had to choose one over the other, subtleties of concentration and states of rapture and all that, or being kind and compassionate to the world around you, choose kindness and compassion. It's better for them, the world, and it's a lot better for you. I guarantee it. Yes?
Focus on that as the path. It's sort of like kind of misplaced.
It's a fair question. So he said that if you focus on these kinds of things, you know, virtue and generosity and kindness and compassion, a lot of religions, or all religions, kind of teach that too. And so, you know, it's not talking about what Buddhism has to offer that's unique. And so that's fair enough to say. So one way to look at that is part of the pyramid, is that what's unique about Buddhism is the top of the pyramid, not at the base. The base it shares, what's at the base are the various foundations as you go along, is shared by a lot of different religions. It's kind of common sense rather than Buddhism. But you need common sense in order to be at the top of the pyramid. So you have to be patient before you get the climax, you know, or what Buddhism focuses on. But even so, I think that kindness and compassion is so central to what Buddhists do. And even people who take Buddhism all the way to the point of liberation, kindness and compassion still become an operating principle for their lives. For many Buddhists, the motivation to reach the top of the pyramid is because of their compassion. So that you don't let go of compassion as you go up. But compassion, in a sense, becomes more and more important the higher up you go. But the deeper or more mature you become in your practice, the further you want to go, the more important compassion becomes to support you along the way. So is it profound? Or is it kind of superficial support? Is it the cutting edge of what Buddhism has to offer? It doesn't work for me to ask that question, even though I think it's fair what you're saying. But my heart doesn't want to go in that direction of that question, because I think compassion and kindness are so centrally important to the whole Buddhist tradition that we don't want to lose sight of its centrality and its importance.
Yes. I only want to say that it seems like drawing that dichotomy between the ethics and the practice is not possible, like that the compassion and the relationship with others is both the beginning and the end. It's the foundation for the practice. The practice also sort of enables us to be, you know, if without sort of dissolving the ego, without what we're trying to do with the practice, we can't be truly compassionate, truly.
Yeah. That's very fair. So what he said, basically said it's a reciprocal relationship, that you can't really be ethical or really be kind or really be compassionate unless you've done a fair amount of practice. The practice supports compassion, and compassion supports the practice. Ethics supports practice, and practice supports ethics. They kind of work on each other. So what's happened here? What I'm giving you is a traditional model of the Buddhist path. Here in the West, what a lot of people have done is turn the pyramid upside down, in a sense. A lot of people start with meditation. And then what they find after they do some years or some period of time in meditation, they realize they have to take care of their ethics. And they have to take care of their generosity, kind of develop that also. Or it develops naturally, many people say, as they meditate. So there's a reciprocal relationship with all this. But I've seen a lot of people for whom doing it lopsided, starting with meditation and going, you know, even going long retreats, hasn't served them very well, because he didn't have a good foundation. And in terms of a dichotomy between practice and ethics and practice and generosity and practice and kindness and love, I don't see that dichotomy. Ethics, generosity, and love are all part of the practice. They are practice. And as practice develops, those become stronger. Yes, Pesha.
A friend asked me yesterday, how do you have compassion for someone when you know they're a jerk? Or you know they're out to harm you. She was talking about ego often.
It helps if you can distinguish between their actions and their hearts, their actions and their being, who they are. If you identify their actions with who they are, then it's hard. But if you can separate them a little bit, then it gets easier, a little bit easier. And then if you can separate out their actions and their effect on you, and look at how they suffer. If they're suffering, then it's a lot easier. If you can tune into the fact that they're suffering, then it's a lot easier to have compassion for them. But if you're not aware that they're suffering while they're being a jerk, it's a lot harder to have compassion. And then the question is, are you willing to stop long enough to notice if they are suffering? No, that person does not deserve it. You know, so you don't stop. But I would encourage you always to stop and see, can you tune into that part? So I want to move on. Now we've had some questions. Yeah. Well, then we'll talk about that. We're going to get into this. This is the subject of today, is love. And as an introduction to this, I wanted to read this letter to give you a sense of how important compassion and kindness, love, is seen by many Buddhists, including these teachers who wrote this open letter. One of the reasons why the whole issue of love and our relationship with other people is important is so we have a sense that our spiritual life is occurring in a network of other people. And as I said, it's a lot easier to take the practice really deep, to have the motivation for it, if you realize you're doing it also for the sake of others. If you're just doing it for your own sake, at some point, I think most people or everyone at some point will stop their practice. At some point, if the only motivation is to improve yourself, it's not going to take you as far as the path can really take you. So sooner or later, I think if a person is going to walk the path the whole way, some level of compassion, some sense that the practice occurs in the field of other people is essential. Okay, so if you'd like to stand for a few seconds, a stretch, and then we'll do a meditation. So taking a comfortable, alert posture, sitting up straight, and gently closing your eyes, and then setting your body at ease, some inner, perhaps a little inner softening or gentling of your body. Let your body be at ease. Let your awareness travel around your body, feeling your body, the tensions, the energies, the various kinds of sensations and vibrations. And as you feel, as you sense your body, see if you can have some ease, physical ease about how things are. Perhaps it helps to soften the belly, relax your belly. And then set your heart at ease, your emotional body, your heart, your feelings. It's fine to feel the way you are feeling. Whatever it is, be at ease about it. And then your thinking mind, your mind. Maybe you've had a very busy mental day today. Be at ease with your mind, whatever way it is, even if it's uncomfortable. Let yourself be at ease about it. At ease with body, heart, and mind. And then with some perhaps tenderness or gentleness, take a long, slow, deep breath, letting the breath be gentle, filling your torso with air, expanding your ribcage. And as you exhale, soften, let go, settle in. Taking a deep breath in, as you exhale, soften your shoulders and shoulder blades. As you exhale, let your face relax. Soften as if there's skin in the muscles of your face. Relax away from the bones. As you exhale, let your weight of your body, in the lower part of your body, settle. Almost move into your chair or your cushion. Weight of your abdomen relaxes down into your pelvic cavity. Be at ease with your breathing. Let your breath be natural. Every way your breathing wants to breathe. And get a sense of the rhythm of your breath. How in-breath follows an out-breath, and out-breath follows an in-breath. Getting a sense of how long the in-breath is, how long the out-breath is. Becoming aware of what parts of your body move or respond to the process of breathing. Movement of your chest, movement of your belly, the expansion of the rib cage. The sensations of air going in and out through your nostrils. As you exhale, you might see if you can let go of your thoughts. Let go of what your concerns are about for now, just for these minutes, so you can just feel the breath more fully. Kind of like riding waves. You're riding the waves of breathing in and breathing out. And then feel your body. Become aware of your body. Sense of presence of your body. The solidity or the vitality of being in a body. Be aware of having a body. Physical body. And then see if you can generate some goodwill towards your body, some well-wishing. This body that's carried you for so long, this body that's been with you, this body that will carry you further. May this body be healthy. May this body feel well. See if you can generate some kindness or some goodwill, some caring for this body that you have. So this may it be that this body feels at ease. Body doesn't have to feel at ease, but see if there can be an inner goodwill towards the body, perhaps an appreciation of it. For some people, it's quite an unusual thing to have goodwill towards the body. With these few minutes here, let there be some kindness there. And perhaps, if it's available to you, you can become aware of some tenderness within you, within the body, some gentleness. Can there be any tenderness about towards this life of your body, tenderness within? Now, see if you can have some goodwill to yourself, not just your body, but yourself in whatever way you think of yourself or sense yourself, who you are as a person. Could you find some goodwill towards yourself? Some feeling about it would be really great if you yourself could be happy, or at peace, or safe. What a great thing that would be. And I'm going to repeat a few phrases, classic Buddhist phrases. And after I say it, silently to yourself, repeat these phrases and see if you can somehow sink into the intention of the phrases. Or see if these phrases can somehow give some focus to having goodwill towards yourself. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I be at ease. Saying the phrases again, at the end of each phrase, letting yourself sink into the meaning of the last word, or the possibility of it, or the inspiration of it, or the happiness of the word, the happiness of that goodwill. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I be at ease. And now bring to mind some person who has been a benefactor for you, some person who has been kind for you, been concerned about your well-being. We really felt this person was concerned or interested or somehow was involved in your well-being. Someone for whom the relationship is relatively uncomplicated. Just feel, you should feel this wonderful person who's been a benefactor in your life. And if you're able to visualize them in front of you. Perhaps visualize them with an expression of happiness. This possibilities of happiness is something that they can manifest. And then see if you can find within yourself a feeling or a sense of goodwill towards this person. Some feeling that, yeah, it would be really nice if this person could be happy or safe or healthy. In fact, you might even, if you could, at least in small ways, help the person, you would offer yourself, extend yourself for that purpose. And then I'll say the phrases over again this time for this other person. You can repeat them silently to yourself, letting the phrases somehow be a channel, be an expression of your goodwill for this person. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be at ease. It is a very beautiful thing when people have goodwill for each other. Goodwill can bring gladness to the heart or delight that such things exist. As you say your phrases of goodwill for your benefactor or your friend, you see, allow yourself to feel, even just if it's just a teeny, teeny bit, some sense of delight or well-being or happiness that your goodwill exists. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be at ease. And then we'll take the last couple of minutes just to sit quietly. Nothing needs to happen. Nothing you need to do except sit here in the quietness of this room.